You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Billy Crystal is one of our most beloved celebrities, a comedian, actor, director, and writer, and the star of hit movies like When Harry Met Sally, City Slickers, Analyze This, and Monsters, Inc. He's been featured on Saturday Night Live, had HBO specials, and for 9 glorious and hilarious years hosted the Oscars. His new book, Still Foolin' 'Em, is part memoir and part a comedy riff about getting older. It's published by Henry Holt, and I'm so happy that it brings him to our show today. Hello.
I am so happy to be here, too.
And Billy, you may be 65, but I must say, you look marvelous.
Oh, you had to do that, didn't
How
you?
How many times a day do people say that to you?
Still, you're the second today. And it's,
really?
That was 1984 we did that.
And everybody thinks that they're the first one to
I know, I know. And that they're just that I've never heard it before and aren't
How did you come
enjoy
up with
that.
The line?
I was just riffing on Fernando Lamas because I used to love him on a Tonight Show. And I just started playing around with him, doing his voice and I was doing Cabaret in stock with Donna McKechnie for the famous Kenley Players in Ohio, for the late John Kenley. And there was a talk show in the lobby of the hotel that we were staying at in Akron, and he did it from a booth. It was a local guy. And from, I thought, well, that's funny. And I started fooling around with Fernando. And I had my own variety show briefly at NBC for a summer replacement. And my brother Rip was one of the writers on the show, and he said, you know, it might be fun to do, put Fernando, who I was doing constantly on the phone with friends and everybody, into the hideaway nets and interview people. So that's what we did.
And you improvise in character?
Oh, yeah, totally. And when I moved him to SNL, when I took Fernando's talent to South Beach, to SNL, it was the only sketch that was not cue carded. So they bring the set, the hideaway set out right to the center in front of everybody where the news usually is. And people knew there were no cards, and it made it even more dangerous. And the host never knew what I was going to ask him, and I wasn't sure what I knew either.
Did you ever come up dry?
No.
Because I work from notes.
Yeah, but see, whenever I come up dry, I would just say, you look marvelous.
I see. That you worked on Saturday Night Live in the mid-80s make up for getting bumped off the show the year before?
I think it was actually better, you know. I mean, I was bumped from the original show.
The 75
to in 1975, October 11th, but I don't remember. And I came back, actually the next year I was a guest, when Ron Nesson, who was Gerald Ford's press secretary, hosted the show. And that was fine, and I didn't do it again for 9 years until Dick Ebersole was producing.
Was Ron Nesson funny?
Was Gerald Ford funny? he was Ford's opening act. That was really great to get to host the show. I did it twice that year. And then Dick said, would you come here? If I get Chris Guest and Marty Short, I would, yes. Mm. Took me that long to decide. And we had a glorious year there.
Well, those are two brilliant, funny people.
Oh, yeah. And along with the remaining cast, which was Julie Louis-Dreyfus and Jim Belushi, Rich Hall, Gary Kroger, Mary Gross, Harry Shearer was there. We had a lot of funny people.
And did most of them write their own material?
No. I can't say that they all did. We all did. And the writers was a good group. But it was sort of a little bit of a patchwork that you had sort of a camp of Chris, Marty, Harry, and me. And then there was Rich Hall, who basically worked alone. He did these great little films. And then there was the remaining cast with one new addition, which was Pamela Anderson. So they had trouble servicing everybody. So, you know, at one point, I think we had written 9 out of the 11 sketches that were on that night, and that was a lot.
This book is the story of your life and the story of growing older. How seriously should we take your kvetching? You don't seem to have lost a step.
Thanks. I've lost half a step, but I seem to have found it the last couple of weeks. I keep myself in great shape. You know, I am 65. I am not thrilled about it, but I'm making what can I do?
So it's better than the alternative.
Absolutely. Really. So I'm having a good time with it. And writing the book was very cathartic in that way because, you know, my wife, who's a very practical person, is always after me to, you know, clean out your closet. Would you please clean out your closet? So this is another way of cleaning out a closet.
You went through all the notes and all the memorabilia?
Yeah, notes, memorabilia, stories, some of which I forgot to put in, which maybe there's another book, or at least I can talk about it on shows like this and go, oh, you know what else I forgot? But when I look at the whole thing, you know, it's an interesting process for me because when I would write with Lowell Ganz and Bob Mandel, when we did City Slickers or Mrs. Santa, whatever we worked on together in the room and we'd improvise and, you know, a lot of my voice and Lowell's voices and Jack Palance's dialogue in City Slickers, we'd take turns playing him. The same with Analyze This, which I did with
De Niro.
Mr. De Niro. Well, I call him Mr. De Niro. It's part of his deal. And now I had to get to the workstation every day and work. And I found it really a wonderful freeing thing to have my own say about how things happen. So when I look at it, I'm very blessed to have had a long and ongoing, you know, life and career.
But the collaborating process in writing comedy has to be a lot of fun because it's really a can you top this process.
Or can you help this? Uh-huh. You know, how do you build this? How do you build that joke, this joke? And I've worked over the years and learned from some of the top people in doing that. I think the best experience with that was at SNL. And also in how When Harry Met Sally ended up becoming what it became.
And Nora Ephron used to tell the story of the most famous line in that, not being her line. Everybody credited her with it, but...
That was a wonderful experience because Rob and Nora, when I was cast as Harry, Meg had not yet been cast. The piece was called Boy Meets Girl at the time. And when I first read it, I have to be honest, it wasn't ready. And when I said yes anyway because it's Rob and it's Nora. And I said, but you know what? I have tons of ideas and things and let me just spit them out. And I threw out all of these ideas for scenes and I ended up becoming in the movie. So then Meg was cast and now we're all together and now we're adding to it and, you know, putting in all these spices and ingredients into this big soup that becomes a script. And Nora brought up the fact that women fake orgasms sometimes. Well, Rob was astounded.
He didn't know that?
Did not know that. And he said, and he's a big bear of a guy. And he said, well, they didn't do that with me. They don't do that with me. Which is a line that Harry actually says ultimately in Katz's Deli. And so Meg then said, well, I should fake one. And I went, yeah, like in a public place, big like a restaurant. There's tons of people around. And we're laughing and laughing. And she goes, yeah, and I'll do a really huge one. And I said, then we cut to an older woman, and she goes to the waiter, I'll have what she's having. Well, we laughed hysterically. Rob then casts his mom, Estelle, to play that woman in the deli. That's Estelle Reiner. So that's how that process happened. So then we get to the set that day, and Meg was nervous. It's all of these extras that she's going to have several orgasms in front of, besides me. And there's 40, 50 people, and she was very shy with the first one. And the second one was like, she's married 10, 12 years. Then Rob goes, no, I want it like this. I want it like this. And he asks her to step aside just for a second, and he then sits across from me and proceeds to have an orgasm that Mighty Joe Young would be jealous of. He's pounding the table. Spice balls are flying off pickles. Everyone's screaming and yelling. And then he finishes, and everyone applauds. And he pulls me aside, and he goes, buddy, I did a bad thing. I said, no, Meg will be fine. She's not a... No, not that. I just had an orgasm in front of my mother. So there's a lot of stories like that that I share in the book.
And the book is called Still Fooling Him, Billy Crystal's new memoir, subtitled Where I've Been, Where I'm Going, and Where the Hell Are My Keys? Because, as I mentioned, it's also about getting older. And one of the things you talk about is falling asleep in theater.
I'm terrible.
Isn't that an occupational hazard for you? Because many of the performers on stage are your friends. You probably have a seat near the front.
Oh, it's really hard. It's really hard sometimes. It's usually after a long day or a meal, or it's just, it started happening. You know, people recognize you in the audience. That's even worse, because if it's a funny play, they look to see if you're laughing. Mm.
Do you snore?
And no, I don't do that. But one time in a movie theater, I was I didn't even realize I was out. And the chapter is called The Elbow. And she gets me an elbow. And I went, what is it? And she goes, it looks like a mob hit. You're covered with red gook. I said, what? And there was like red vine drool on my white T-shirt. It looked like somebody had shot me to the heart.
I guess you got a taste of your own medicine when you performed your show 700 Sundays for an audience in West Palm Beach.
Well, they were, I hope they're not mad at me, but it is what it is. And they were a delightful crowd. I was very excited about going down there to the Kravis Center. We were on this national tour, and we did 5 dates there, and I have a lot of family and friends down there.
Was that like doing the Borscht Belt?
It's very much similar. I never really played there. I played Kutcher's once and the Concord once. I never really, we went there once. So I wasn't like that, but it's the same kind of audience.
They were a tough audience.
In the Catskills?
In the Catskills.
Yes, which we depicted in Mr. Saturday Night. You know, somebody invented these wooden clackers. And it was supposed to be, if you liked somebody on stage, you'd hit your table with it and make a noise, right? Then somebody, probably one of my cranky relatives, said, you know what? What if I don't like somebody? I'm going to hit the table even harder. So many acts who, if they weren't doing well or the audience didn't like them, they'd start hitting the table. Oh, my God, what a horrible feeling.
Didn't you try to stop someone in the audience from recording the show?
Yes.
How did you find out?
Well, I saw this. I'm on stage, and I see this red blinking light, which to me means somebody's videotaping the show. Piracy. Can't have this. Come off, and it unnerved me. So I come off at intermission. It's not like I can stop and, hey, you, what are you doing? So I sent them out. I said, back of the house on the right side. So they come back to my dressing room at intermission. I go, did you get him? He goes, well, actually, it was the life support system of the guy in the wheelchair. I said, well, Mr. Compassionate here goes, oh, put some black tape over it. It's driving me crazy. She says, you can't do it because the nurse will think that he's dead.
Well, it might have been good to have had it filmed, because you're going to be bringing the show to Broadway, and we'll talk about that after we take a little break.
Okay.
You could probably compare how the show has progressed over time.
Could be.
Meanwhile, we have Billy Crystal here, comedian, actor, author, 9-time Oscars host. He has written a memoir called Still Foolin' Him, Where I've Been, Where I'm Going, and Where the Hell Are My Keys? It is published by Henry Holt. We're back with Billy Crystal, who has written a memoir called Still Foolin' Him, Where I've Been, Where I'm Going, and Where the Hell Are My Keys? It's published by Henry Holt. And your show, 700 Sundays, is coming back to Broadway for a limited run at the Imperial Theater starting on November 5th.
November 5th previews for a week, and we open officially November 13th.
If you can memorize and single-handedly perform that show 8 times a week, doesn't it kind of undermine what you're trying to tell us about aging in this book?
No, because for me in particular, I only have trouble occasionally with names. All that other stuff I'm fine with. I don't wear glasses. I don't wear reading glasses. I'm the only one of my friends who at a restaurant doesn't hold the menu out like a trombone player. Can you see the specials?
I have to take out my cell phone and put on the magnifying glass.
Oh, really?
That light.
Yeah, so far I'm okay. Yeah, I have always, from the time I opened on Broadway, have felt that's the greatest experience of all. And I really look forward to coming back there.
But a lot of actors have told me that 8 times a week is exhausting, and they're usually in plays with other people.
Well, I don't do 8.
Ah.
I do one very long show That's interrupted by meals and, for the men, shaving. I do six a week because, you know, when we first opened, I was doing seven shows a week, and you could barely stand by the Sunday came around. And then we cut it down to six, and then occasionally on a road I'll just do five. You know, the show is 2 hours and a little bit, so it's emotionally and physically demanding. But I want to, you know, try and get the audiences a chance to see me as often as they can, you know.
What do you mean by the title of the book, Still Fooling Them? Do you feel like you're getting away with something?
Everybody feels like they're getting away with something. Don't you feel like you were?
No, I think this is a hard job, and I'm worth every penny.
That you don't make?
And I hardly make any more than a few pennies.
No, it's a mantra that I've had. There's a chapter in a book called Still Fooling Them. It's sort of what I say to myself right before I head to the stage again. You're still getting away with this. You know?
Are you surprised that you get laughs on certain lines?
I'm surprised at the different kinds of laughs. I think that's what makes it so interesting and fascinating every night is, why didn't this crowd laugh at that? And you can't take anything for granted. The one thing I really learned was the discipline of every night of doing that show actually made me a better actor working alone, because there's nobody else up there but me, and I owe them the best I can be that night. They've paid a lot of money. They've waited. They want to see the best. So,
and you have to make it look like this is the first time you ever
yes,
did it.
Yes, and my concentration was so razor sharp, and has to be, to remember every nuance. But you also have to let in the vapors that they give you and breathe them in so you can give them something fresh every night. And I was able to do that.
On the other hand, Jon Stewart says that he realized when he took that hiatus this summer that the world didn't laugh at every stupid motion that he made. Every time he moved his hands, they laugh when he's doing the television show, and he had a hard time handling that.
Well, he was also in the Middle East directing a movie. It's a tough place to get laughs. The Middle East is a rough room.
Your father was the manager of the Commodore Music Shop, produced jazz concerts, Commodore Records.
My uncle, Milt Gabler, who's one of the great record producers.
Gave a Strange Fruit with Billie Holiday.
Not only that, Rock Around the Clock, Red Roses for Blue Lady, Volare. He wrote L is for the Way She Lay. He wrote that song and Dunkershane. But his breath as a producer and creating America's first privately owned jazz label, which was the Commodore, back in 1939, was, you know, he was a giant. And so we were around the great mostly Dixieland stars when I was a kid.
Well, you also had to think a lot about improvisation. Now, improv in music is different than improv in theater, but in the end, it's still about coming up with something and bouncing off of
and coming
the other
back
people.
And coming back to your main theme. You know, it's really it's different in theater as it is for stand-up or comedy, which the rhythms and the intonations, how you read a line, how you hit the punchline, are very much like statements in a jazz solo. And their influence on me when I was a little kid was infectious, with great players and characters like Zooty Zingleton and Miff Mole and Big Chief Russell Moore and Pee Wee Russell and Pee Wee Irwin and Marty Napoleon and Willie the Lion Smith and Henry Red Allen, Eddie Condon. These are great players that I was always around when I was a kid.
And did you think of going into music? Because you started college, you were a baseball player.
I was a baseball player and I played high school basketball, but I was also in the band. And I also, in the eighth grade, had a Dixieland band called the Long Beach Junior High Five. And was Steve Lazar on trumpet. I don't remember the rest of the guys. So I learned about, you know, when you have a clarinet in your hand, and somebody like Pee Wee Russell is trying to tell you to just tease it out. Don't use so much breath. Just tease it out. And, you know, you can't help but love these guys. And even though I wasn't the best musician, I was okay, but I loved their spirit. And more importantly, I loved the way that they laughed and made each other laugh. These were really funny characters.
Yeah, some of the the funniest stories I've ever heard have been when musicians have gotten together, start trading stories. Mm-hmm. But do you think that music taught you to listen to the musicality of speech? Because you've done such great imitations of people like Muhammad Ali and Sammy Davis and Howard Cosell.
But it started with those guys. It started with the jazz guys, with Zooty, and a drummer named Freddie Moore. I don't know if you remember Freddie. But one of my first characters that I did was a piece I did on Saturday Night Live with the Ron Nessen Show, was a piece called Face, which was I played this old jazz musician who I'm in the audience of, and I see him, and he was a guy who I really loved when I was a little kid, and I go backstage to see him. And that's the piece I did on SNL. It wasn't a funny piece. It was a bittersweet piece. And the hook of that piece was the old guy saying to me, "Can't you dig that? I knew that you could." And that sort of caught on. And John Travolta used it in Saturday Night Fever, that line. And I saw John not long ago, and he still quotes it and says, "You know, I stole that from you." I says, it's okay. It's cool." But that sort of started the ear. And, you know, when you're in a living room, say, or a Passover, and you got Zooty Zingleton on one side and my Uncle Morris on the other, you're going to hear stuff that's going to be funny.
It's like Charles Ives. Yeah,
do I smoke the bitter herbs? What do I do with these things?
So why didn't you return to Marshall for your sophomore year? You were on a
Because
baseball
I met
scholarship.
A girl that summer who I knew I was going to marry, and I thought if I went back to school, it would not work out, and it's the best decision I ever made. When I met Janice that summer, I just thought, well, this is more important.
And you've been married all these
43 years. Yeah,
you started doing skit comedy, and David Frost just died recently.
I saw that. He was one of the first people that hired my group.
You were supposed to be on. That was the year that was.
Oh, it was hilarious. It was a special. Avery Schreiber and Jack Burns, who were a very funny comedy team.
I remember the cab driver.
The cab driver. Cab, taxi, remember the new Boston guy and the cab driver? David produced it. That was the year that was. And we were a guest. It was three of us. We were called, at that time, We the People. We then changed our name to Three's Company. We had more names than good jokes. And we did this bit where I was to play a sort of Ted Baxter kind of actor who's hired to do a marijuana commercial. And my two partners, Dave Horth and Al Finelli, were the crew, the director and the stage manager. And of course, during the course of the takes of the commercial, I would get progressively more stoned until we were just laughing and forgetting the dialogue. And I actually started to eat the cue cards because I got hungry. And so the piece played in front of a live audience, and it was really funny. And it was an ABC special, and we thought, this is our break. We're, you know, the only other comedy group at the time was the Ace Trucking Company, if you remember them. So we taped the show. So it was going to be on, I think, a Saturday night. So we have a party at my apartment. We're on our way. Here we go. We're going to be on network television because it had really done well in front of the live audience. The show comes on. We're not there. I look at the clock. It's now 3 minutes to the hour is over. Come out of commercial. There's Jack Burns and Avery and the rest of the cast saying, "Good night, everybody. That was the year that was." And everyone's waving, and there's a shot of me and Dave and Al waving. They couldn't cut us out of the waving because we were standing behind Burns and Schreiber. They cut us out of the show, and then the phone rings. It's my relatives. "Very good waving. Nice waving. You're a good waver."
Billy Crystal has written a memoir called Still Fooling Him, Where I've Been, Where I'm Going, and Where the Hell Are My Keys. It is published by Henry Holt. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So you thought that was going to be a big breakthrough. What was your big breakthrough? Was that when Jack Rollins of Rollins and Jaffe, the manager of Woody Allen, Dick Cavett, and others, came to see you at Catch a Rising Star?
Well, actually, one of the people who worked for him, a man named Buddy Mora, who would become my everyday manager, who worked under Jack and Charlie Jaffe. We were doing a demo tape up at Buddha Records, and Robert Klein, who was one of Buddy's clients, who I still thought at that time was really one of the great stand-up comics I ever saw. He was so good. and an influence on everybody. And he was coming in because Bob was going out on tour, and we were like auditioning and making this demo tape with two friends who were up at Buddha Records. And one of them said, well, you know, Buddy Moore is here. And I didn't know. He said, he's Robert Klein's manager. So he came in, and we just did stuff for him in a room. And he started working with us. And you know, we would play a little place here, a little place there, and took us under his wing. And he and his partner, Larry Bresner, said, listen, the group is good, but you're not going anywhere. If you ever thought of being a stand-up, we're there for you. And that was really all I needed to hear. I was 26 years old. I already had a baby. I was behind in that way, you know.
Struggling?
Yeah. Because, I mean, you know, most I made was $4,200 a year. Plus, I was a substitute school teacher just trying to make my way and have a baby. And that was all I needed to hear. And then by chance, a friend of mine called me and said, listen, we're having a fraternity party at ZBT at NYU. Do you know what a comedian can do 15, 20 minutes in front of the folk singer? And I was actually feeding my daughter, who's now the mother of two herself. And I said, well, I'll do it. He goes, when did you start doing stand-up? I said, no, I've been doing it for a while. Lying, lying, lying.
And still fooling him.
Yeah. And he said, where is it? And I said, he said, Mercer Street, the ZBT house on Mercer, so on. I said, 8 o'clock. All right, I'll be there. And I went, oh, my God, what did I do? And then I threw some stuff together, took some things I was doing with the act and made it just for myself. And instead of 15 minutes, I did an hour and something. I didn't even remember what I did. And then they said, let's get to work. Now, Buddy came, Larry came, and Jack Rollins came, who was the dean of comedy managers at that time. And that sort of started me on my way.
And early in your career, you were hired to open for Blood, Sweat, and Tears.
That was a rough night, but a fascinating night. See, when the audience has no idea that there's going to be an opening act, especially a comedian, that's rough because they have timed their drugs for the headliner. So David Clayton Thomas, this is, I think, a very funny story in the book.
He was the second lead after Al Kooper.
Yeah, but he was the vocalist. Yeah. He was the big vocalist. And he was having trouble on stage for a period of time, throwing fits and so on and so forth. A great singer. And I opened for them, and it went really well. It was in Scranton, Pennsylvania. So I stick around to watch. Usually I would leave, but they were the hot band, Spinning Wheel and all that stuff. And he walks out on stage. Crowd goes crazy. He sings three lines of What Goes Up Must Go, and then starts screaming and cursing and walks off. Curtain comes down. Crowd is stunned. They then tell them there's a sound problem. We'll be back in a few minutes. They come to me. The drummer, Bobby Columbia, says, get back out there. So I only had 20 minutes of material, so I went back out and started playing around with the audience. Where are you from? Where are you from? And I started working it, and it got really funny. Now they really like me. So they're ready. So I walk off. See you. I hope not again. David Clayton Thomas comes out. Same thing happens. He blows a gasket. Thing comes out, and Bobby says, go back out there. I said, I can't. I know where everybody's from. So then it happened one last time, and then they gave me $25 extra. But it was a great experience. Those days of in the 70s, comedy was just starting to be a thing that worked with rock bands, and the clubs were starting to become a network.
Earlier, it was comedians working the burlesque circuit.
Yeah, but this now was—it just started to get very cool.
Was soap the big breakthrough for you?
It was one of the big
breakthroughs. And you played a gay character, which was pretty amazing at the time.
It was—you know—I look back on that, and that was 1977, and the things that I acted on that show with my partner, who was played by Bob Segrin, who was an Olympic gold medal winning pole vaulter. And he's now playing a gay NFL quarterback who played my love interest. We did stuff on the show, 1977, that some places don't even do now. You know, some shows don't even do now. And I think about it and I go, you know, that was pretty cool what we did. And if we were in any way, along with, you know, Susan Harris, who wrote, and Tony Thomas and Paul Witt, who produced the show all the way back then, if we were in any way helpful to getting more gay characters on shows, even to this day, I feel very proud of that.
You are a Yankees fan, but you wear a Mets baseball cap and jersey and city slickers. Who came up with the idea for city slickers, and what did Charles Bronson say when you sent him the script with him playing Curly?
You know, it was my idea to do the movie. I came up with a story of it, and then it was really just like I was watching this show, and it was about fantasy vacation. Someone had sunk an old destroyer, and you could dive into it, and guys would go with their friends. And I went, well, that's interesting. What about a cattle drive? It was sort of serendipitous. And I even wrote down three friends, midlife crisis, going cattle drive at a dude ranch, old cowboy trail hand. And I wrote Jack Palance dies, guys have to bring in the herd themselves, secrets that friends have, stuff like that. And then I pitched it to Castle Rock, which was where Rob was, and I had a dealer at the time, and we made the movie.
I can't get to all the other things. It took you a while to really, you did some wonderful things, but it took you a while to become Billy Crystal in the minds of most of the general public.
I wore them down.
You had Spinal Tap. You had all those other things.
I had little things. Yeah, I had little beauties in there. Spinal Tap, The Princess Bride.
And you have to be proud of all of them.
Oh, yeah. I the book is, a look back at some really great moments in my life that people don't know about.
And if you'd only start drinking coffee before you go to the theater, everything would be
I've
perfect.
Done that. No, it hurts my stomach, and then I'll be running to the bathroom.
Billy Crystal, comedian, actor, author, 9-time Oscars host.
And the DH for the New York Yankees for one day. They should have put that on there.
And Joe DiMaggio punched you once.
Yeah, there's stuff in here that...
Can't get to all of that stuff, but thank you so much for being on our show to talk about your book, Still Fooling 'Em, Where I've Been, Where I'm Going, and Where the Hell Are My Keys, published by Henry Holt.
Do you validate parking?
No? We'll talk about that later.
Okay.